We begin the hour by welcoming in our friend writer Colin Fleming, whose newest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro, is available everywhere. Good day, Mr. Fleming.
What's up, Kimbalicious?
Well, I'm joining you in whatever small tertiary role I can play to clean up the English language.
They say that that's what you're about. You are a Pied Piper of eloquence, sir.
I don't know about that, but there are some things that, as the kids never say, stick in my craw, and you have identified a couple of them, starting with should've.
I was on a walk today, quick 4-mile walk, and I thought about how I wanted to handle this, but I did not wish to be draconian and come across as a nasty, embittered man. So realize, everybody, I'm trying hard to be super nice. This is a nice time, and the should of, the preposition, not should have, is ubiquitous now, and I don't know. I don't think it makes me a bad person that I can't take you seriously as a thinker or human being if you repeatedly write should of. Does it? I mean, it undercuts your argument completely, doesn't it? And I find that the people who are most vociferous in how correct they are about something, although they're probably not going to be, are like the biggest users of the should of construction.
In the spoken word, I'll even accept shoulda before should of.
It's funny. I was saying this to someone the other day. I have a hard time. I can't, in fact, say something aloud if I can't see what it looks like in my head. I can't say a word that I don't know how to spell, for instance. It just makes me feel unmoored. And I've always been that way because language for me has so many other qualities to it than the sound and the sense. It has architectural properties to it. It has painterly properties to it. It has sculptural properties to it. And I need to really feel that word and see that word and all of that before I can say that word, those series of words. So when I see like the should have, it speaks about who you are. Because I think really that old trope about we're only as good as our word, and that means that you live up to the things that you're saying, you say you're going to do. But I think it also means that like your language reflects the quality of your mind. I think there's a direct parallel there. When you write the should have, and you know what? It's not something that existed 5 years ago. Like, because I read all day. Words are something that I deal in all day. And so I notice when something is going to be this new trend. It's something that's really come up over the last 2 years. It didn't exist before that. People put the have. But that speaks to the devolution that happens, and I think, in plain view, and people just tend not to be aware of it.
I think part of that is the tendency toward internet speak. The other thing, it seems to me that people have a difficult time with contractions, and I think that goes to the way we teach English now in many schools. The days that at least I grew up in, and maybe you did too, of students somewhere along the way diagramming sentences, I think those days are gone.
It's ironic. When people say, of all the people who probably know what this is, and I've also studiously avoided it, I don't even know what it means to diagram a sentence, but I was talking to my mother lately about my niece and my nephew, who I was actually speaking to before I came on the phone with you, and she was telling me about how kids don't learn phonetically anymore, but still, if you were going to get out of second grade or third grade, you would have to have mastered the things that people don't seem to have any mastery over anymore. And internet speak is one thing, the whole dreaded to me that you are construction. I found it out like, And then I think like, you are text, like, what are we referencing here? The Dead Sea Scrolls. I'm like, wow, everyone's really smart, but that's not what's happening, of course. But should of isn't a truncation. It's not internet speak. Do you know what I mean? It's
right.
It's a phonetic rapine of reproducing words that have no value beyond you're just going by the ear and you're not going by the eye at all. You have a disconnect between ear and eye. If you have a disconnect between ear and eye, you're going to have a disconnect between other things like your mouth and your brain and so on. And it just, it goes out of control. And I really, when I see a should have, it's like taking a blade to the side of my soul. I feel it. It's like a kind of internal blow, and I just despair.
And you mentioned the eye and the ear, and I think in terms of the eye, a big part of this, I see it with students and with spelling often. And I believe it's because people don't read anymore. And I know, at least for myself, if I'm writing, I know when a word looks wrong because I read a lot. And so if I'm writing and I didn't spell something right, it will jump out at me. That's wrong. It looks wrong to me. But I don't see that as much with young writers as I did, even 10 years ago.
You can see right away on dating sites who not only reads now, but who read as a kid, who had parents who were like, try reading a book. Maybe just don't sit down in front of the television. You'll see people, for instance, who float a comma in the middle of just between words. There are spaces on each side of the comma, and they do that every time, like, you mighty comma, you don't deserve to a butt. Well, I wouldn't say a butt. You don't deserve to touch the word in front of you. And you'll see these other people who put after a period, if they even use periods, they'll put like five spaces before the next sentence starts. I know right away that person doesn't read at all. And part of the problem, as we've discussed, is you have an industry that doesn't give people anything to read. But also, I've never bought the idea that this reading is so boring or anything, because who really has, in a sense, a shorter attention span than anyone, and who wants to be rambunctious? But little kids. And there aren't a lot of little kids who are like, get that book out of here, Mom. I'm not into that. If you give the kid the book from an early age, even before they can read themselves,
yes,
they love the object. They love the idea of story being relayed to them. They love being read to. It calms them down. It fascinates them. And even these kids who have technology, they still like a book. Like my sister's kids, they're always with the book. They always want to be read to. They pretend that they already know how to read. In fact, my nephew was recently ahead of my mom. He was like on chapter 7 of Meatheads, and he was lording that over her, which I kind of enjoyed.
Another term that bothers you and bothers me, literally.
Oh, goodness. All right. Literally, people, does not mean extra, super, duper, really true, which is how people use it.
Oh, yes.
Beatles were literally the best band. No, that's not how that works. Literally has a physical component to it. I guess that's a good way to, you want to know when you can use it. There's going to be something almost always touchable, something that's going to be bodily. Like if you say Patrick Mahomes literally carried the Chiefs on his back, is you'll see people, these idiots like Skip Bayless. Like, you make your living with words. You make millions of dollars. You're sub-literate. Like, you're barely functioning as somebody who can read. And he literally carried the team on his back. Now, it's possible that you could literally carry the team on your back, but it would be a Hercules-type act of a guy going down, like, whoa, it's the 50-yard line, and there are these men stacked upon his shoulder blades. That's awfully impressive. That's what it would have to be. But whenever someone wants to throw down the gauntlet and say, ha-ha, I have won the argument, they throw out a literally. And they also usually use the word fact incorrectly as well. For instance, it's a fact. Fact is kind of like a corollary of literary, because fact usually has a mathematical component to it. If you say it's a fact that Wayne Gretzky scored 92 goals in 1981-82, that's accurate. But if you say it's a fact that Wayne Gretzky is the best hockey player of all time, it's not,
no,
because you don't have that tactile mathematical component to it. Now, what you might have is more than a fact, something that pulls rank on a fact, and that's a truth. Truth is like the ultimate end-all, be-all. But we often blend those things together, preference, opinion, fact, truth.
Colin Fleming reminding us that words is good here on Downtown. From there, we move to Twitter. Oh, the wonder that is Twitter. The nature of Twitter followers, a world where people are obsessed and concerned with the number of people who follow them and like them on Twitter. And we were talking about this earlier today, that there are people in the world, I think one of the reasons that For instance, television hosts on certain networks are complaining about losing Twitter followers is because they often get performance bonuses for having followers. And as you've told us many, many times in the publishing world, that's often a question that people will ask, well, how many Twitter followers do you have? As if that equates to, well, anything.
With this cull, with the whole Twitter thing, and I'm not like advocating necessarily what's going on across big tech platforms right now, but what I am seeing is how much people have their identities bound up in their number of followers. Mm-hmm. All sorts of people from all walks of life. And what I've learned about Twitter is I'm the most, this is a fact, you could look it up, I'm the most published person in the world in terms of number of venues that someone has been in, at least like living right now, 2,500 things and across all of these different subjects and areas. And then you'd be very hard-pressed to name a major venue that I've not had my work in. What do I have, 100 Twitter followers? Now, like, what is the thing about me? I'm not reprehensible. I'm not vile. I'm convivial on the air with you. And as you know me. This is how I am in all of my life. It's how I am in my work. It's how I am in the blog and my website. No one would follow me because I'm also smarter than the people who have these massive Twitter followings. The way you have the huge following is it's all about mediocrity. It's all about a lack of talent, and people glom onto that because it's non-threatening to them. So for someone like me, who would like to have a large following because I want to reach more people with my work, and I believe I will, but for me to have that, it has to come from something else rather than what I'm saying. Now, all of these things that I'm saying right now, which make perfect sense, I put them out there in some pithy, catchy, Twittery way. There isn't going to be anyone who shares that, or you'll hit the like button, or a few others, but for the most part, no one will. And yet, it's a level of literacy that other people don't possess, where they're just fumbling about clumsily with words. So that's something that I've noticed. And Thoreau, in his journals, he said something along the lines of, people really want an average man, and they do not want greatness. And he qualifies it. He says, in fact, the larger problem is when we introduce absolute greatness. He wasn't talking about himself necessarily, but he could have been. And he was on to something. That's something really that for all of the issues that I'm facing, blackballing in an industry, all of these crazy things, which sounds paradoxical with all the work that's always coming out and all the books and whatnot, but it's complicated, hence the blog. That's really the ultimate problem for me to find a way to solve. And it's a horrible thing to have that be what is, in a sense, imprisoning you. It's not because you've done something heinous or you touch kids or you do whatever, number of things that people do, and really a blind eye is turned. It's that. And so I actually look at it as encouraging. If you're saying something compelling, witty, funny, inspirational, you're not going to have any Twitter followers until something else happens that brings people to you.
I think there are two things that happen. There are those people who have many of those skills or even all of those skills, and there are people who follow them simply as fans who want to be a part of that and feel some connection, but there might not be a lot of interaction between them. But then there are a lot of people, and many of them are in that mediocre category, who also have decided that the best way to get more of those people on board is to pander to them on a regular basis.
To pander, to issue screeds, but we diverge there because I can't name someone with a large Twitter following where I think they're intelligent. I just never think that. I see people like, oh, this is a famous writer, and they say something along the lines of, well, this year wasn't Thanksgiving with all these COVID deaths. It was Thanksgraving. That's horrible. That's not good writing. That's not witty. That's nothing that anyone really appreciates. It's more just like, please like me or like me back or share this. I never am taken aside and thinking like, okay, well, look at that level of bon mot we have there. Look at that insight about this football game from these so-called talking head experts on sports. I think that people crave the thought of, I could do that. And I have a friend who says, it just sounds like bar talk. It doesn't sound like...
Oh, well, yes,
like,
yes. Sports Twitter is like watching Wheel of Fortune. When you watch well-known people tweet, you think, well, I could do better than that.
Sure. Back when they were cookouts, and I'd have like these uncles or whatever, you could get like the same thing from my uncle on Tom Brady or whatnot that you could get from these people with 4.1 million followers. So, like, what's the distinction? It's not knowledge, it's not the language, it's just what? It's the name and the fact that it's moronic. And I'm not someone who subscribes to this idea that you have to be completely stupid for people to like what you're doing. I do believe that people like interesting things so long as they're accessible. So that's the difference maybe between liking the British version of The Office, which is a huge hit, right? And Finnegan's Wake, which is not accessible. You sit down if you're a construction worker. I mean, you could be a construction worker and smarter than Proust for all I know. But you sit down and you watch something like the British version of The Office, you're crying because it's so moving, it's so relatable, it's so accessible. So I think that mediocrity is the cynosure of our society right now, and we trend towards it. We encourage the making of that mediocrity. It's a very bland, homogenous, stoopy mix.
Let's leap from Twitter to the National Football League and the postseason, and you got a little tidbit about Philip Rivers that maybe no one else has made us aware of.
I do. I was watching the end of that game, and no one pointed this out. And it's like in the past now, so it doesn't really matter. People talk about things like, for instance, when we discuss Twitter, you see these repetitions of phrases, noodle-armed, right? Everyone starts using the phrase noodle-armed, and they mystify it, just like they do the check notes thing. But when Philip Rivers had to throw the ball away twice at the end of the game, right? So like the third to last play and the second to last play, did you notice how long it took him to get the ball out of bounds?
I wasn't watching, so no.
So, like, the ball is just, he's throwing the ball away intentionally. But this is where arm strength actually really hurt the Colts. Because each time, and I played it back, there was a second longer than it should have taken for the ball to get out of bounds. So what you end up with is a Hail Mary situation about the 50-yard line with 4 seconds left with a guy who can't reach the end zone from there. If he can put the ball out of bounds faster, because the whistle doesn't blow until the nose of the football has broken that plane of the white boundary, you would have had 6 seconds. You can run another play, have a sideline out, and then like a 51, 52-yard field goal, and that completely could change the entire nature of the postseason, right? And now that, to me, was just a really obvious thing, that this ball's trajectory is up in the air for so long each time. This 2 seconds are huge in that context. And it's like, okay, why does no one tweet about this? I mean, it's like basic math. It's how sports work. There's the time component, and it's like nothing.
I saw someone today on Twitter, of course, say that Brady had beaten Bill Belichick. And I don't even know what that means.
The debate that people want to have that I think is a non-starter. The debate doesn't make sense to me because you're not going to be able to have it play out anyway. Like, who was the real cause of the Patriots' success? Because Brady will be gone in a year or two, right? And Belichick will carry on. And just even if Belichick does not come close to replicating that level of success, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, because how many years do you expect, even if you're the best coach ever, to really have that level of success? If you go through like all the great coaches and all the sports, for the most part, unless you have like a monopoly-like situation, like the Montreal Canadiens of the 1950s or the Yankees of the 50s as well, where you're just like hoovering up everyone else's talent, then you really only just have this flourish. Like, Don Shula is not great, like, year in, year out for decades. Tom Landry or anyone else that you want to name. So I don't really understand that argument, but you certainly can't base it on a single year, right? Mm. I mean, it's like people have short memories. Back in 2003, the Patriots had so many significant injuries. I remember that was like the year Troy Brown was playing defensive back,
right?
And Brady was good, but he wasn't like 4,700. Well, nobody was really 4,700 yards, 65% completion rate good except like Peyton Manning at the time. But a lot of things went wrong for that team. And they still go 14-2, and they go through like a gauntlet to get to the Super Bowl, which they were able to win, and maybe it shouldn't have been that close. But people don't talk about that when they make the case for Belichick.
All right, from the NFL to the National Hockey League, and you've written an op-ed that hopefully somebody smart will publish, talking about the schedule as a campaign of hate. Tell me more.
Yes, it's also a really nice song by the Libertines from their second album, Campaign of Hate. But I like this idea of not so much the condensed schedule as the fact that you play the same teams over and over and over and over again. And what the op-ed focuses on is this idea that there is so much animus in our society right now. I don't know what the dominant trait of our society is. Maybe it's animus, maybe it's hypocrisy, but animus is up there. And it's a negative all the time. It doesn't bring out the best in anyone. I find a way to have it bring out the best in me. I've been dealing this week with, a personal attack. And that has motivated me even more than I'm normally motivated, not to like just throw roundhouse punches, but get in book proposals, write a story, write this op-ed, because I'm able to turn that level of, well, hate, if one wants to call it that, into a motivational device. And so the reason the NHL playoffs are so great, I think, is because you have two teams beating the bag out of each other for a fortnight, and you have no choice in that context, if you wish to prevail, but to elevate your game. You have to stay within a framework of rules. You can't like sort of go beneath a given baseline and be able to compete. So what ends up happening is each side, who can't stand each other, ultimately brings out the best in each other. And so I think that's what you're going to get with this NHL regular season. You're going to get the regular season as playoff season. And really a lesson for everyone else that you don't just have to try to kneecap people. Maybe it's a way, sometimes, animus, to foster your own growth.
Well, it's always easy to kneecap people if you're not going to see them again. But as you point out in your piece, in many ways, it's a throwback to the early days of the old six-team National Hockey League.
Can you imagine how just brutal it was, intense it was, playing in that original six? And, like, think about even something like just being a goaltender. Think of how hard. I mean, it's just crazy. There were only six goalies considered strong enough in the world to start in the league. That's nuts.
Yeah, and not wearing masks either.
Right. And then you have to deal with Maurice Richard. You have to deal with, I mean, Gordie Howe. Can you, like, playing Gordie Howe however many times it was a year, like 14, can you imagine how much that sucked? And, like, each time that you're playing someone like that, because the best athletes have the longest memories, don't you think?
Yes.
They remember things like, yeah, we went into the corner and you gave me that slew foot or whatever it was. And they're going to pay you back for that. So you sort of like make choices knowing, as you said, that you're going to have another visitation. And I think in life, if we looked at it that way, that you will have another visitation, you'll come around again, people would act a lot differently towards each other, don't you think? Because we do trend to being cowardly, to sort of like, you're in traffic and you give someone the finger, but you're not assuming you're going to pull up even with them at the next red light, right? You're like, I'm out of here, sucker. You'll never see them again. But it's different if you're going to encounter them later. And I think that's a good way to live your life. Kind of always assume, even as you're beating the bag out of someone, that would you beat them so thoroughly and enjoy it so much if you were to see them again? And if you would, and you did, then more power to you and just, like, savagely have at them. And I like that level of sort of game-rising competitiveness.
Brilliance on display every Tuesday afternoon with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Check out his work at colinflemminglit.com. Follow the blog, subscribe to that, many moments more. And, of course, if you haven't already, what is wrong with you? Get your hands on Meathead's Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro, available everywhere. Thank you, Colin. We'll do it again next week.
Sounds good, sir.